I'm delighted now to welcome Steven Pinker. He's a John Stone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, author of many books, including The Better Angels of Our Nature. And he and Rebecca Goldstein, the great novelist and professor of philosophy, will be giving a lecture titled On Moral Progress, Is the Human Conscience Led by the Head or the Heart? That's on Wednesday, the 14th of August at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So in your book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, you make the case that many listeners might find counterintuitive or just inaccurate that the rate of violence worldwide has not only declined, but declined precipitously over the course of human history, even in the last century. We have a tendency to romanticize the past and focus on how terrible and violent the present is, but we're actually living in a remarkably peaceful era. What's going on?
The decline of violence has taken place over a number of different timescales. So some of the declines are recent. Many people are not aware that there has been a huge decrease in the number of wars and the number of deaths in war since 1945. But even before that, there was a huge decline in the rate of homicide compared to the Middle Ages. We've also eliminated many barbaric practices like burning people at the stake or breaking them on the wheel or using the death penalty for shoplifting and blasphemy. And most recently of all, there have been a number of rights revolutions in which we have targeted violence on smaller scales, such as beating of children, violence against women, including domestic violence and rape, both of which have been in decline. Even most recently, violence against animals, where there are increasingly stringent regulations on the use of animals in research. There's been an increase in vegetarianism. So across many fronts, we see violence decreasing on a number of different scales, but all pointing in the same direction.
We have in our long human history not only war, but this phenomenon of raiding, which was the cause of so much death and brutality and suffering. And this is particularly true in places and in times where there's no nation states, where there's basically anarchy and groups living kind of near each other, but without any kind of central government. Give us a sense of the kinds of things that our indigenous ancestors did to one another.
Yes, people often think of indigenous peoples as having ritualized and fairly harmless warfare because they think in terms of our battles of two armies facing each other on a battlefield and engaging in pitched warfare. And that does happen in indigenous peoples, but it's correct to say that that's not the major cause of death. What more often happens is that there will be an ambush of a hunting party by another tribe or village. There will be a pre-dawn raid. There'll be various stealthy and indeed, you might even say cowardly tactics to minimize the risk of harm to the attackers. And those can really add up. They can result in massacres of entire villages. And it's in that kind of violence that indigenous people have a high chance of coming to bodily harm.
So much for the myth of the peaceful indigenous people populating the world.
Yes, that is a myth. I mean, it's not that they're more violent by nature. We've got violence as well, but they certainly were not pure and universally cooperative and beneficent. What they did not have that we have are things like police forces and courts and ways of resolving disputes that are short of violence. Now, it must be said that many indigenous peoples do have conflict resolution techniques. There's sometimes adjudication. There are man-to-man single combat fights, but they aren't as effective in halting cycles of feuding and vendetta, where each side feels that there's still a grievance that's still left to be settled, and so the hostilities often can be never-ending.
In what ways is human violence similar to and different from our nearest primate relatives?
Well, it depends on the primate, because there's a lot of differences among even between the our two closest relatives, common chimpanzees and bonobos, the so-called pygmy chimpanzees. There does seem to be a commonality between some kinds of indigenous warfare and the kind of raids in which groups of related male chimpanzees will ambush and pick off an isolated member of a neighboring community, often leading to the decimation or even extinction of a neighboring community as they pick off the males one by one. But there are many differences as well. The kind of ideological forms of violence that results in genocides from political movements like Nazism or and communism, or religious wars where ideas spread that encourage violence. That we can be uniquely proud or ashamed of that. You don't see that, and certainly in other animals.
You write about the five types of violence, and one is predatory, which we certainly do share with animals, and dominance, which we also do share with animals. And revenge and ideology seem to perhaps be uniquely human. And then there's sadism. We have a terrible long history of sadism. Does that have evolutionary roots as well?
I doubt it. Sadism often requires considerable planning and ingenuity, sad to say. And it seems to be an acquired taste that people cultivate by overcoming the natural inhibition that we have to causing unprovoked harm in someone else. Paradoxically, it can become a source of pleasure, almost in the same way that other things that are initially unpleasant can become something that we savor when we gradually expose ourselves to it and find that we are not harmed by its usual risk, like skydiving or strong tasting foods or saunas or other extreme experiences. Sadism might be a bit like that. You find that you can overcome your revulsion to harming someone with your bare hands, and people even come to enjoy it.
There's the most brutal history of violence as entertainment, and it goes on for millennia. I mean, we have crucifixions, we have torture that people would go to watch. Even in the 20th century, people would take picnics to lynchings. Is this a universal phenomenon? Is it a phenomenon of civilization?
It's a common. I don't know if it's literally universal, but you certainly see it in many, many cultures, including many indigenous ones. So it's not a product of cities and modern governed societies. Many of the first European settlers remarked on how there were spectacles of cruelty among some native populations. Of course, at the same time, Europeans themselves had plenty of them. So there's some pot calling the kettle black there. But it is not a recent invention of so-called civilized societies. That's right.
So how did the whole concept and phenomenon of human rights come into being?
It's a surprisingly late and exotic concept. The idea that every human, or nowadays perhaps even every conscious creature, including non-humans, has a right not to be harmed is not something that you see in any of the traditional moral codes. It's certainly not in the Bible, where it's pretty clear that you should be nice to members of your fellow tribe. But the idea that no one should be killed or harmed by virtue of the fact that they're a human being is a pretty late concept. The Greeks were another very advanced people, one of which Rebecca Goldstein has a great deal of expertise, and she'll be speaking about them at the at the lecture sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. But even among the Greeks, it did not seem to extend to all of humanity. They kept slaves. They warred against other city-states. Probably the first really systematic statement came around the time of the European Enlightenment of the 18th century, of the Universal Declaration of Rights prior to the French Revolution. That didn't last long in Europe, as the various wars of conquest and colonial expropriation show. It was then revived after World War II with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights associated with the founding of the United Nations. And I think it has been expanding since then. It's certainly the creed that all international organizations adhere to, as well as most liberalizing religions. Again, not universal, but I think making inroads. And it is responsible for a number of the more specific human rights movements, such as the movement for religious freedom, for women's rights, for gay rights, for civil rights, and so on.
What were the intellectual conditions? I mean, you talk in your book about the Enlightenment that really gave rise to this way of thinking.
We don't know for sure because it happened so few times in history that we can't really do a statistical survey, but I suspect that the growth of cosmopolitanism, of the movement of people and ideas, was instrumental. That the time of the European Enlightenment was also the time of the huge expansion of printing, affordable written materials, literacy, travel, correspondence, the rise of the novel, as it continued to unfold in the 19th century, the rise of the mass media in the form of affordable newspapers. And then there's the new burst of human rights consciousness in the 50s and 60s. It may not be a coincidence that those were the era of the of Marshall McLuhan's Global Village, enabled by advances in electronic technologies such as television, long-distance telephones, satellite transmission, jet travel. Certainly areas in which people and goods moved freely, big port cities like Amsterdam and London and Boston, were often hotbeds of liberal and democratic thought. They were big enough and free enough that various heretics and radicals could find a niche in. And also, as people came together in salons and pubs and coffee houses, they could exchange ideas, traditions that couldn't be justified by themselves could be evaluated and attacked and discussed in free speech zones. And I think those were prerequisites to the consciousness that human rights is the only defensible moral worldview, as opposed to, say, tribalism or deference to the authority of kings and priests.
And, I mean, just simply the exposure to the reality that people who look and speak differently from the way we do are just as human as we are and often just as nice and interesting as we are.
Indeed, yes, and that is another important point that I should have emphasized. But yes, indeed, that as the lives of other people become more real to you through perhaps drama and fiction and journalism and rubbing shoulders with other people, it's harder to demonize them, to dehumanize them, to think that they somehow don't have experience, that they're like robots or like animals. And so I do think that the mixing of peoples, and both physically and virtually through literacy and fiction and drama and so on, had a humanizing effect.
Now, we may be believers in human rights, but you can't have human rights and fight wars at the same time, because when you fight wars, you are killing people who, if you believe in human rights, have the right not to be killed.
Indeed, that's right. And they do often go together, that is, an awareness of human rights and an opposition to war. There were some of the first systematic anti-war sentiments around the in the 18th century, after centuries in which war was just considered the way that nations did business. It was considered the normal state of affairs, and conditions of peace were the exception. But people started to speak out against it. It was intermittently successful. The 18th century had a relatively lower rate of war and death in war. That was partly reversed by Napoleon in the early decades of the 19th century, then massively reversed, of course, in the decades between the 19-teens and the 1940s. With the horror of World War II and the world, I think, finally sinking in that war is a pretty stupid way to resolve disputes, we have seen a bumpy and uneven but unmistakable decline in war, which I think is, and not coincidentally, it's the same era that's seen a rise in the recognition of human rights.
We're talking to Steven Pinker. Now, you mentioned before that when you have the rule of law, when you have nations, there's less violence because there are mechanisms for conflict resolution, there's courts, there's police forces, and things like that. How would you characterize the difference between peace in a nation that's caused by people living under democracy where they have personal autonomy and conflict resolution and all of that, and peace caused by essentially repression, I mean peace at gunpoint, so to speak?
Yes, those are the two the two constraints that I think all civilizations have been trying to negotiate, namely finding a middle way between the violence of anarchy, where you're preyed upon by your neighbors and the people in the next village and tribe, and the violence inflicted by government. The good thing about a government is that it keeps people from each other's throats, and the bad thing about a government is that it itself can prey on people. I see the general move toward democracy as and responsible government as a way to try to have the advantages of government without the disadvantages. That is, a government that is licensed by a social contract. Its only raison d'etre is to serve the people, to protect them against each other, without in turn aggrandizing its own power or preying on people. We certainly haven't hit the perfect balance, needless to say, but that, I think, is what the world has been muddling its way toward over the centuries.
Now, in your book, you describe violence, which is so horrible that, I mean, I had to kind of like skim over it and turn the pages and get to the next part. But I mean, it's a kind of violence that evokes the deepest revulsion in us, or most of us. Was that revulsion there all the time when people, I mean, in Rome, when they were burning people alive and for entertainment, or is that culturally instilled? What's going on?
It depends. I think that people don't need a whole lot of encouragement to take pleasure in the suffering of people that they think have harmed them. That I think everyone takes pleasure in vengeance. Today, we fortunately don't experience it as much firsthand, but we certainly enjoy it when we go to the movies to see the bad guy meet his comeuppance. In terms of pure sadism, that is, some guy who has not, as far as you know, done anything to harm you, but you just enjoy watching him being torn apart by lions or, what you say, in the Roman Colosseum, that, I suspect, needs to be cultivated. I think there is an initial revulsion to seeing an innocent person harmed for no good reason. But unfortunately, it's a kind of revulsion that, as people overcome it, it can turn into a kind of gruesome pleasure.
So we're born with that revulsion, but it can be trained out of us, basically.
Yes, and it can be trained out of us more quickly if we imagine that the person being harmed is being legitimately punished for some harm that they have done. But we can also take pleasure in innocent people being harmed. I mentioned one practice in 15th century France in which people, as a form of entertainment, would watch a cat being lowered into a fire and burned to death. Certainly they had no animus against the cat or no reason to think that it deserved to be punished, but nonetheless they just took pleasure in watching the cat howl and scream in agony until it was reduced to carbon. So that shows that capacity is present. I don't think it's an innate taste. It's certainly one that we all find absolutely revolting, even though we probably don't need that much encouragement to enjoy watching a bad guy being shot down in a movie.
Although I can't help but think that the capacity for empathy is something that is also cultivated over time, and I think many of us become more empathetic the older we get.
I think there, too, there's some elasticity. I think we're all born with the capacity for empathy, and certainly you do see it in very small children. They will comfort people in distress. They'll help people who have run into trouble. They will dislike, even infants before they can talk, will dislike cartoon figures that harm other cartoon figures and will prefer to interact with cartoon figures who help other cartoon figures. But who is the legitimate beneficiary of our empathy? There's a lot of elasticity. And I think by default, we tend to empathize with people who are our friends, our family, are visually attractive and cute. The idea that we should empathize with ugly strangers is something that has to be taught. And I think you're right. I think that does tend to develop with adulthood. Kids often come up with surprisingly intolerant and racist remarks about people who are unlike them, even at the same time as they are perfectly willing to help someone who they feel is close to them.
Now, the United States, as you describe in your book, is historically and currently considerably more violent than other civilized countries. Why is that?
It's not uniform across the United States. You know, on the whole, in almost every statistic of violence, we compare unfavorably with other Western democracies. Our homicide rate is at least five to ten times higher than that of other Western democracies. And, of course, we're more likely to get involved in foreign wars. At least that's been true since 1945, not true before that. That tendency is most concentrated in the South and the West. The northern states, their rates of violence are somewhat higher than those of Europe, but not as dramatically higher as you see in the South and the West. I think it's because the South and the West were in a state of anarchy until recently. They were, we all know of the stereotype of the Wild West and the mountainous South, the Wild Frontier. And by the time government came around, the people learned to protect themselves with a code of honor that a man has to protect himself and his family by responding to insults or threats or attacks. By the time government came around, people were no longer willing to outsource that function to the government. They wanted to reserve it to themselves. In Europe, and to some extent in the north and the coasts, which were heavily influenced by Europe, the government imposed its will on the people much earlier, and people never really had the option, at least in the last few centuries, of being responsible for their own safety. And so you didn't have the same macho code of standing your ground and never giving an inch and responding to insults with violence to prove your manly honor.
Well, there's also the problem that we have that we, in certain places and in a lot of places, have racist police. So if you are a person of color, you know you're not going to be protected.
That's right. I mean, and that cuts both ways. The police have often preyed upon citizens, but also they don't take the safety of their minority citizens as seriously, allowing a lot of violence within the communities to proliferate. That is, their enforcement of justice is so inconsistent, where they'll just think, well, those people, they're animals, they're just going to attack each other, why should we get in the way? And then every once in a while, they will kind of capriciously brutalize some members of the community. And I think that's partly responsible for the higher rates of violence in many African-American inner-city communities. That has been changing as both the rates of violence have come way down and the relationship between the police and the communities has vastly improved, particularly in cities like Boston, where the police have worked with the preachers, with the local business people, with the community organizers to do what's in everyone's interest, which is to prevent innocent people from being preyed upon by thugs. So the police have a positive role to play in protecting a community, as well as the responsibility not to prey on them themselves.
We're talking to Steven Pinker, professor of psychology and author of the book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. I read your chapter with great interest on what you call the kind of decivilizing process that happened in the 1960s and 70s when there was a breakdown of social mores that went hand in hand with civil rights struggles that really had a positive effect. Help us to understand this era, both the decivilizing and the civilizing process of all those struggles that were going on.
Yeah, it was in many ways a paradoxical decade. It was supposedly the decade of peace and love and Woodstock. It was also the decade of Altamont, that is the Rolling Stones concert in which a fan was stabbed to death by Hell's Angel, and members of the Jefferson Airplane were beaten up on stage by Hell's Angels who had been hired to provide security. It was an era that a lot of people forget was one in which crime, rates of violent crime went through the roof. The rates of murder, rates of rape, rates of robbery and vandalism all soared during those peace and love 60s. I think there was a concentration of energy on to reduce institutionalized forms of violence, such as civil rights violations and war, and later violence against women with the advent of second wave feminism. But what was neglected was the kind of one-on-one violence that is best prevented by both an effective law enforcement system and also a culture of self-restraint and inhibition and norms of self-control. And of course, the 60s were the era of doing your own thing and letting it all hang out and taking a walk on the wild side. And when you got a lot of young men hanging out together and taking a walk on the wild side, part of that wild side involves violence. And that's what we did see in the 1960s.
Do you think that the people who were listening to Lou Reed and so on were the ones who were perpetrating armed robbery and rape?
Well, I don't think that Lou Reed deserves much of the blame, but a number of the journalists and intellectuals and judges and politicians were listening to the art forms of the 60s and were less likely to prioritize keeping thugs off the street. In the 1960s, there was a lower probability that a crime would result in an arrest and that an arrest would result in a conviction. Everyone just assumed that the root causes of crime were poverty and racism and that it was blaming the victim if you would take thugs off the street. There were a lot of kooky ideas about the street violence, that graffiti was an expression of artistic impulses, and that even you saw a number of respected figures saying that rape of white women by black perpetrators was a natural response to racism, and that that it shouldn't be condemned too severely. It was a form of racial self-expression. Fortunately, the feminist movement put an end to that kind of nonsense by putting the interests of women back in the spotlight. But it was an example of the kind of nutty idea that opinion makers and elites were all too ready to entertain. And I think that the changes in popular culture were part of that complex.
Would you say that the roots of crime are not poverty and racism?
Not entirely, no. We've seen that by the fact that the eras that were where, in fact, racism went down, such as the 1960s, were eras in which crime went up. And crime has occurred throughout human history in societies that were more racist, less racist. I don't think that it's the first place to look. And likewise, although it is true that poorer people commit more violence of certain kinds than wealthy people, there are forms of institutionalized violence, such as wars, which are not perpetrated by poor people, but by wealthy elites. So the relation is a complex one, and I don't think it's accurate to say that that the root causes of violence are poverty and racism.
The title of your upcoming lecture is a question: is the human conscience led by the head or the heart? And I wonder if mind and heart are separable. And I ask this because it seems to me that the ability to think clearly is inextricably bound up with your emotions, good emotions, bad emotions. I mean, anger and fear affect a person's thinking, and so do kindness and empathy.
They do. I think they definitely interact, but that doesn't mean that they can't be separated analytically, that is, in an effort to understand how things work. So it's not that they proceed in isolation, but I don't think they're the same thing. I think they're dissociable in the brain. There's the limbic system, which is the generator of emotion and motivation. And then there's the cerebral cortex, particularly the prefrontal cortex, which is the seat of reason and deliberation. They're heavily interconnected, so you're right that they interact, but I don't think they're the same thing.
And so then let's talk about this whole question of moral progress and the decline in violence that we have seen and that you've been talking about must be at least partly a sign of moral progress. And still, we have this problem in our society and our media that there are opposite and competing moral systems. So a large part of our society glorifies soldiers in war and opposes people's right to be gay, and the other side is morally against war and they're against the oppression of gay people and so on. So what one calls moral progress, the other calls moral decline. How do you sort this out?
That's certainly true. And what people moralize is not the same as what we could argue is truly moral, with using the best possible arguments. But over time, I have argued that the debate shifts, that what used to be considered to be more exact, human rights violations that used to be considered perfectly fine, over the course of history tend to become, even by the more conservative aspects of society, tend to become delegitimated. So just to give you some examples, there is no argument anymore for racial segregation, except among the extreme fringe lunatics, but not even the most conservative politician would say, let's go back to Jim Crow. That was a debate that was held in my lifetime. There is no longer a debate as to whether women should be in the workforce or whether there should be any legal discrimination against women. There's no longer even a debate over gay rights in the sense of homosexuality as a criminalized activity, that is, sodomy laws, only struck down at the Supreme Court level in 2004, and now just no longer a topic of debate. It's shifted to gay marriage, and I think you can see the writing on the wall that even gay marriage in our lifetimes is going to be a fait accompli and no longer even a subject of debate. The idea that war is something that is inherently desirable because it promotes manly virtues, and that a nation should fight wars even without a cause because war is good for the national character. That was a very common argument prior to World War I. Now it's gone. It's not that all arguments for fighting particular wars are gone, as we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they have to be justified by some end that the war is a means toward. The idea that war is inherently a good thing is just no longer a respectable position. So I see, even though you're absolutely right that at any given snapshot there are differences in what people think is moral or immoral, the snapshot changes over time. And it changes in general in a direction that we would call progressive or liberal, in the sense that the conservatives today tend to be more liberal than the liberals of 50 years ago.
Interesting. We were talking before about entertainment. Violence is entertainment. And here we have a world in which there are so many violent movies, and a lot of people love watching violent films. I can't watch them, but I mean films in which people do the most horrible things to one another. Those same people don't go to documentaries about real wars. Those documentary films audiences are filled with peace advocates who don't go to these other films. What's going on?
Yeah, certainly there's been no reduction in violent entertainment and simulated violence in sports and in movies. But what we have seen is a dissociation between the simulated violence that people in the audience enjoy, and the actual harm that comes to real-life flesh-and-blood creatures. So you can watch the most gory, repulsive, sadistic movie in which people just get blown to smithereens and hacked to bits and gore and blood spattered all over the place. And then in the closing credits, it says, no animals were harmed in the making of this motion picture.
Right.
So I think that, that tells a story, which is that we're, I don't think human nature has changed. I think we still enjoy the watching violence happen to simulated enemies or simulated evildoers. But at the same time, we have become more moral in the sense that it's all pixels now. It's not actual Christians being fed to lions or animals being literally shot in front of in front of the cameras. Likewise, even forms of extreme sports, ultimate fighting and cage fighting and so on. It's gruesome to watch. I think it's kind of, personally, I think it's kind of gross, but it's extraordinarily popular. But nonetheless, there's actually less harm that comes to the participants than in, say, boxing, whose popularity has been going down, where basically the purpose of boxing is to cause brain damage. Whereas in ultimate fighting, there's some scratches and some tears and some sprains, but it's actually quite mild stuff. A friend of mine, Jonathan Gottschall, is writing a book on ultimate fighting in which he actually engaged as a participant to know what he was going to be writing about. And he lost his first match against a guy who was a male nurse who immediately friended him on Facebook after their match. So we compartmentalize the violence so that it titillates us, while at the same time knowing that it is it's kept within its box and that no one is really hurt.
There's so much debate about whether that kind of violence, whether it be in movies or video games or whatever, makes us less empathetic. Do you have a view on that?
I think probably it depends on the context, that there are some kinds of violent entertainment, ones that dehumanize the person being harmed, that could lead to a decrease in empathy against certain groups. If they're seen as a less than human, if they're seen as a group deserving of the violence that's meted out against them. But I don't think it has to. If it is if it's space aliens, if it's targeted against individuals who are clearly committed acts of evil by choice, then it doesn't necessarily generalize. And in general, the studies that look for correlations between violent entertainment and violence in real life, when the studies are properly done, show that there's no connection.
Now, there are so many things that we hear in the media about our violent society, and you coin the term a false sense of insecurity?
I don't deserve credit for coining it, but I did reproduce it, yes.
Right, which is basically, I mean, all these, the tremendous increase, certainly in my lifetime, of violent stories in the media and on the news and so on. But as our actual rate of violence has decreased and New York City is a safe city and our homicide rate has gone down and so on, all these things that they say about terrorism, for example, you know, the existential threat of terrorism, the capacity to end civilization, those actually become true when we look at the violence that we're doing against nature. So global warming and pollution and the degradation of the soil and the killing of the oceans actually do have the capacity to tremendously harm civilization, to drown our coastal cities and so on. How do you see that in this whole question of the violence? I mean, we're no longer doing it against each other. We're doing it to our own host, the Earth. I mean, what's going on?
Well, I think it's clearly unwise, perhaps even suicidal, to foul our own nest in the way that we're doing it. I don't think it's the same as violence against sentient creatures. I mean, it's stupid to continue to pour carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, but it's not as if the atmosphere feels pain in the way that a cat does if you burn it alive, or a person does if you crucify the person. There, I think it's the violence is a metaphor, but I don't think it's the same phenomenon. I don't think we're punishing the atmosphere. I think we're just doing our thing for our own well-being and are heedless of the consequences. So I think psychologically it's different, and I think it's practically in terms of what we ought to do in order to mitigate the harm, I think it's also different. I don't think the atmosphere or inanimate things have rights in the same way that sentient creatures have rights. I think obviously we ought to be conscious of what we're doing, but for more practical reasons, namely that we're going to be harming ourselves and other sentient creatures inadvertently, but harming them nonetheless.
Right. And I suppose you could make that argument for example, what we're doing in the oceans to sentient creatures.
Yes, although, well, there are two different issues there. One of them is, is it cruel to harm the fish? But that's really a question that we could ask even if we were fishing sustainably. That is, every fish that's caught in a net, even if they're plenty more and we're not harming the fish stocks, you could feel sorry for that fish. And that is one set of arguments and it would deserve to be taken seriously. But another is, are we decimating the fish stocks so that future generations won't be able to fish? And I think that's a separate question. The question of sustainability, of using the resources in a way that benefits us without harming future generations, is a different question than the one of whether we shouldn't be eating fish in the first place because the fish suffer. Each
right.
individual fish suffers because you're suffocating it by pulling it out with a net. Even if we were fishing sustainably, an animal rights activist could raise that issue. As it happens, we're not doing that sustainably, and we're decimating fish stocks regardless of the feelings of each individual fish. We're not leaving any fish behind for our grandchildren to exploit in the same way. I mean, they both might be wrong, but they're different kinds of wrong.
Right, exactly. Now, women, whom we haven't really talked about, tend not to be the perpetrators of violence, and there are so many generalizations made about human nature which would probably be better made about the nature of half of human beings if you're going to generalize. How do you see the role of women in all these questions around morality and moral progress?
Yeah, in general, that is right. Violence is in large part a guy thing, not exclusively. One of the reasons that I subdivide both causes of violence and causes of nonviolence in my book into a number of categories is because different ones are gendered to different degrees. Just calculated instrumental violence, violence as a means to an end, I don't think there's that much of a sex difference there. If you have, say, a female head of state and she is playing chess against other heads of state, there doesn't seem to be any evidence that a female head of state is any less likely to wage a strategic war or a defensive war when the need arises, where it's just kind of like it's a calculated tactic. For more stupid kinds of violence, macho posturing, in insane wars of conquest, wars of aggrandizement, that really does seem to be a guy thing. Or at the personal level, road rage, lethal conflict over a parking spot or over use of a pool table, lashing out fatally in response to an insult, that is much more of a guy thing. There seems to be a correlation that societies in which women are more empowered tend to be societies with less violence. Again, it's a statistical generalization, but it's one that may have a number of causal pathways. One of them being that stupid forms of violence are just less of a turn on to women. Another being that when women are more empowered, they tend to have greater control over their own reproduction, and so you tend to have fewer youth bulges that often are exacerbators of violence. You've got a lot of unemployed men in their 20s, that's generally not a good thing, and you're likely to get that kind of situation in societies in which women are turned into baby factories and don't have access to contraception or marital choice.
Well, I find it interesting. There's women who are empowered, and then there's women in societies where they have the choice to be empowered who are very much supporters of whatever macho posturing their men, their soldiers, whatever, are doing.
Yeah, and in general, that is true, that in across societies, the opinions of men and the opinions of women tend to be correlated. So it's there's no real sisterhood in the world where women across the world societies agree with each other and disagree with their men. However, within any given society, if you compare the men and the women, in general, the women will have more pacifist opinions. So in a warlike society, the women might have more bellicose opinions than the men in a more peaceful society. But you compare the men versus the women in any given society, and the men are more hawkish, the women are more dovish on average.
So in this trajectory away from violence, away from blood sport, away from homicide, toward peace and democracy and so on, I mean, nobody can predict the future, but where do you think we're headed?
Well, in some areas, you can see definite trends in laws and customs regarding the treatment of women. I think there'll be continual improvement, uneven, and both across the surface of the world and across the years, but that's the direction that the world is going. I think that'll be true for gay rights. I think it'll be true for in government forms of violence such as capital punishment. The trend of the world is to move away from capital punishment. I think wars between countries are definitely on a downward trajectory. You know, country A declares war on country B. Other forms of violence are harder to predict. Certainly, civil wars and terrorism are harder to predict just because all it takes is a bunch of men who get their hands on some AK-47s or some bombs, and they can do a lot of damage. In a world of 7 billion people, you can't really predict that groups of men like that will not arise anywhere. Homicide, again, because it's not a question of a custom that is legislated with a stroke of a pen, but decisions of hundreds of millions or billions of people, it's a little harder to predict. My hunch is that we won't go back to the high rates of interpersonal violence that we saw in the 1960s, but with much less confidence than institutionalized practices such as capital punishment or laws that discriminate against women or gay people.
I mean, it's interesting. The thing that I find concerning is that because of the environmental destruction, which you rightly say is not perhaps caused by the same violent tendencies that we have had in the past toward each other, could cause refugee situations and shortages and wars that lead to an escalation in the kind of violence that we've been getting away from.
It's possible, although it's not generally the case that that refugees and that deprivation lead to war. You can have a lot of misery and suffering without organized armies facing each other on the battlefield. And conversely, a lot of pretty horrific wars had virtually nothing to do with environmental stress or shortages. They had to do with toxic ideologies and bad decisions. So there are lots of reasons to be concerned about environmental degradation, but it's not that as people become more miserable, as land becomes drier, wars are an automatic product.
Steven Pinker is Johnstone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University, and he and Rebecca Goldstein will be giving a lecture titled On Moral Progress, Is the Human Conscience Led by the Head or the Heart? On Wednesday, the 14th of August at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute. It's free and open to the public. For more information, santafe.edu. Steven Pinker, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thanks for having me.